how do we experience God in a time of crisis? Which may be to ask, how do we experience God? How do we experience a disruption of our sense of identity and purpose that transforms us and calls us to a new way of life?
The discovery of God, the discovery that God is actually something that almost always unmakes us, unmakes our ideas of ourselves and our group and our life.
Reverend Dr. Sarah Batchelard is an Anglican priest and founder of the Benedictus Contemplative Church in Canberra, Australia. She is the author of several books, among them Resurrection of Moral Imagination and Experiencing God in a Time of Crisis. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Sarah Batchelard, it's such a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking me.
I often ask people about how they imagine faith, especially relative to their work. In your case, that's a richly layered question since you've written so beautifully about faith. So let me ask you a group of three questions here, if I may. Here's the first question, just most simply. How do you imagine the role of faith in your life and work?
Great question. I guess perhaps for me, the first thing to say about faith is that it's a kind of a felt experience of entrustment, I guess. So, there's a quote from the philosopher Wittgenstein, which I know is daunting to introduce Wittgenstein so early in the conversation. But he says, someone who is holding on to their redemption or who believes in resurrection is like someone who is suspended from above. And they look like the same as someone who is standing, but the play of energy within them is completely different. Mm. And I just found that a really helpful description. So it sort of looks like you're living your life like everybody else, but there's a sense in which you have allowed yourself to entrust yourself to a holding. And in that entrustment, there comes both a kind of rest and relaxing almost, but also a sense of poverty of spirit. And that changes the flow of energy within you. And that makes all the difference. So when I think about the role of faith in my life and work, it's that sense of being entrusted, being held, that's really at the core of it, I think.
I think that's really moving. In fact, you write about that somewhat in your book, Resurrection of Moral Imagination, which I love. Talk about the experience you had on the schoolyard with your mother when she was present there, that sense of being held, even when she wasn't present, the fact that she was there in the schoolyard meant you felt differently in relating to those around you and the world around you, which I think is profound. That book that I just mentioned, Resurrection of Moral Imagination, presents a rich set of reflections about faith, especially Christian faith, faith in Christ's resurrection, that causes us to think differently about the world around us and how we treat other people. It's a very powerful book. Is there a personal story behind its origin?
I guess that too is a layered thing. So there's no one answer to that, and it's not like, oh, I had an experience of the risen Christ once and therefore ... It's not that kind of an experience. Sure. But I guess in a way part of its origin is that I guess an animating concern of all my work and my own faith journey and my life journey has been this question of getting at the livingness of the Christian tradition and the faith tradition. And I grew up in and around the Anglican Church. You know, wasn't a particularly religious family, and in the US, people probably know that that's Episcopalian. It wasn't a particularly religious family, but I was certainly taken to church, and I was always very drawn to it. There was something in it that kind of beckoned me. But I also, for a long time, all through my teenage years and early 20s, right through studying theology, felt like there was something that I wasn't on the inside of, that people would say certain words or, you know, talk about their experience of Christ or what their faith meant to them. And I kind of wanted it, but I felt like I couldn't get access to it. And that led me to leave the church after a while. I kind of thought, oh, well, you know, somehow it's not for me, or it's not connecting for me, or there's nothing here, actually. They're just talking about it, but it doesn't actually connect to life. And so I think part of what was behind my writing that book is seeking to articulate both more fully for myself, but also then for others, well, where does this really connect to our lived experience? And what is the difference that the resurrection makes? You know, Christians say things like it's the beginning of a new creation, but what does that actually mean? You know, so that's the kind of journey that's behind that book, I think.
And that really communicates itself. It's a beautiful book. I really love it. And it does capture the aliveness, the vitality of faith. I was going to ask you a third question about faith, but instead I'll fold it into another question here, because I think you've spoken to what I was going to ask you, I think, already very well. You write really beautifully about the contemplative experience of God in a different book titled Experiencing God in a Time of Crisis. And you draw a distinction there between our ideas of God on the one hand and an experience of God on the other. And you say that, you know, the one, our ideas, can almost become like an idol, like idols, whereas an experience of God is an expansive and sometimes disruptive reality. Can you elaborate on that distinction between the idea of God and the reality of God?
Yeah, well, again, quoting somebody else, but I quote him, I think, in that book, Experiencing God in a Time of Crisis, but the English theologian James Allison says, God is a terrible idea and a wonderful discovery. and I guess what I take him to mean by that is that, you know, so often our ideas of God, the idea of God is the, you know, the kind of critics of religion or those suspicious of religion say it is, which is just a projection of our own need or our own identity, or, you know, God made in our or my image. Whereas the discovery of God, the discovery that God, and that's probably all there is to say, is actually something that almost always unmakes our ideas of ourselves and our group and our life. And it can't then be neatly packaged back into an idea that we get a handle on or a possession of. Of course, it is human, and it's certainly my own kind of need then to seek to articulate something about that, you know, to put that into words, to kind of have it come back to us it comes from a different place than when it comes just from our idea. The play of energy in theology that comes out of that place is different from theology that's seeking to kind of present a package, if you like.
Sure. Okay. I'm going to ask you in a minute about this unmaking. You talk about how on occasion our experience of God causes us to sort of unmake our own big life stories. I'll get to that. It's a really important point that you make, and I think you make it very, very well. Before we get there, can I ask you another question about experience? You make a crucial distinction in your book about experiencing God, right? Between experiences that we have and those we undergo. The ones that we have are more instantaneous. The ones we undergo happen over time. And, you know, we all know of narratives like biblical stories of people experiencing God in the sense they have this supernatural event occur. You know, the angel Gabriel appears to Zacharias in Luke 1, or Saul has a vision of Christ on the road to Damascus. But most people tend to experience God in the latter sense. They undergo an experience over time. Does that distinction strike you as significant? I ask this also because, you know, you are a contemplative thinker, and contemplation often implies things undergone over time. What does that mean to undergo, then, an experience of God?
I think I'd want to make the distinction between having and going just a little bit differently to the way you just articulated it, Matt. It's not wrong what you said, and there is that sense of that, you know, a particular happening and something that happens instantaneously, as you said, and something that kind of unfolds over time. So, but I think that the core of the distinction I was trying to make with that having undergoing is the distinction between a possession, between an experience that we have, and then it just becomes part of the identity, enriches the identity we kind of more or less already had. So the experiences that people want to have on their bucket lists, I'm going to have the experience of, you know, going to 20 countries in 15 days, and then I'll have done that, and I'll have that, versus an experience that yes, we have it, like something happens, but also we undergo it in that it kind of has this radical shift. And sometimes that can happen quickly, as in for Mary and the angel, or Paul, and, you know, that something happens and something's all of a sudden different, but they're different too. They've undergone something which has deeply shifted them. And so whether or not that takes a long time or happens in an instant, the point is the experience, we don't kind of keep having the experience. It's more like the experience now has us.
Oh, good.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Yeah, that's a point you make in both books that I've read, Experience of God, Time of Crisis, and also Resurrection and Moral Imagination. I think that's a better way to put it. I was kind of going after kind of the traditional short versus long experience you find like in philosophy. But what you're talking about, I think, is that's a better way to conceptualize it than the question I gave you. Let me ask you this about these kinds of transformative experiences, right? These experiences that change us in the process of having them, such that we're not the same afterwards. The title, tell me whether you think this statement is true or false. You know, the title of your book, Experiencing God in a Time of Crisis, might that be shortened just to Experiencing God, in the sense that disruption is an implicit part of that kind of experience? Is that a true statement, or would you also want to qualify that one?
No, I think that probably is true. And in fact, in a sense, as I wrote into that book, it sort of became clearer that God and crisis are kind of go together, you know, crisis in that sense that we're talking about, a kind of turning point, some kind of fundamental shift. Which again, sometimes can be sudden and sometimes can be a slow burn. So that I guess our mental image of crisis is often that it's a kind of something short and sharp, even though the aftermath can take a while. But I think you're right. I think it could just be experiencing God. And I guess part of the theme of crisis in that book was sort of to relate that God can precipitate us into crisis. Crisis, which appears to be unrelated to God, like something difficult happening in our lives or the world, can precipitate us, as it were, into God. And so it kind of moves both ways, I guess.
Sure. All right.
Yeah.
Which takes us back, I guess, to that statement you made earlier about unmaking. You talk about how an experience of God often attends the collapse of our life stories. Can you elaborate on that point a little bit about what you mean by life stories and how this experience can really goes to the unmaking of how we imagine ourselves to be?
Yeah. Well, I guess when I'm speaking about life story or the narrative that we have of our lives in that context, I guess what I'm thinking about is what you might call the egoic story, or the kind of the identity that we've constructed for ourselves or had constructed for ourselves by our culture and family and experience. And we're all, as many people have said, we're sort of meaning-making creatures. We think narratively. We're constantly trying to make sense of our experience by putting them into stories, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's a kind of necessary part of becoming a self, that we be able to tell a story about our lives. But I guess the Christian faith tradition has this has this revelation that that's not all there is to us. And if we stay just inside that story that we've told or had given to us, there's a larger story that we kind of need to be porous to or to be opened into. But often, because it's so frightening to let go of the fragile kind of construct of meaning that we've managed to cobble together, it does take some kind of rupture to begin to destabilize that or kind of collapse that in the most and I guess that's what if you look at many of the biblical stories through that lens, that does seem to be a persistent feature. You know, you think of Moses meeting God at the burning bush, and right, there he is. Or Paul, you mentioned Saul, Paul, like, and often it is symbolized by a change of name, actually. Saul becomes Paul, Jacob becomes Israel. It's kind of like right there in the text that there's some new identity being opened out here.
Nice. Can I quote a little passage from your book here? I've got it all marked up. It's a beautiful book, Sarah. This is one I've liked. It's kind of on that theme right here. You say, a mark of God's independence from our fantasies about God. And I'd say from our fantasies about ourselves to our life stories.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. It seems to me, you say, is the consistent testimony of those called that they are not necessarily thrilled about it. Right. There's an ordeal. There's a sense that it is transformative and that's difficult, that change, that kind of transformation is not just light-minded. It's not as simple as changing what you want for dinner, that there is something about this which really does cause us to go through a process of reevaluation, which is strenuous.
Yes, I think that's right. And, Yeah, and again, it's there in the Gospels. You think of Jesus calling the disciples. There's a life they had that they're leaving behind at some level. And of course, there are all kinds of subtleties here, because there are continuities, and there are, and it doesn't do this call, this transformation, this shift in identity doesn't do violence to what I would say, you know, the fullness of life in us. In fact, often once we've kind of yielded to it, and sometimes it's painful and sometimes it's prolonged, but there comes a point where you feel like I'm more myself than I ever was, or, right. You know, I've lived into the fullness of myself, or phrases like that, which again are kind of mysterious. Who is this self that I wasn't but now am, and, you know, all of that. But so it doesn't do violence to us, but it is a kind of a, there is a sense that this, the fundamental seat of our being or our identity is being shifted. And again, I think that connects then to where we started with the lived or the felt experience of faith, which is somehow our foundation is different now.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. No, that's very nice. Do you, these egoic life stories, these identities that we have, that an experience with God can tend to shatter or deeply revise, once these life stories have shattered, do they shatter more easily a second time or a third? I mean, is it the kind of experience where we go through a series of perpetual transformations, and does confidence in God grow with these shattering experiences? We become more adept at living without these egoic or strong life narratives.
Yeah, I guess I just speak for myself, and people can see if this resonates with their experience. I think my sense is that, as St. Benedict said, that the process of conversion is continuous. You know, so we're in this process of continuous conversion, and because the journey of faith, we never arrive. God is always kind of calling us deeper and beyond. And so yes, there's a sense in which we keep having to, you know, to kind of let go and trust at a deeper and deeper level, which is this continuous conversion or transformation. I guess my experience is that the word shattering doesn't feel like it keeps being the word I would choose to with these iterative kind of processes. I think early on there can be, and maybe we'll also come back to whether shattering is always the right thing, but for now let's stick with that. And I think in my experience, again, a shattering, like probably there were two major shatterings that I can think of, you know, that you kind of, because the first one, often, certainly my experience, you scramble to put yourself back together, more or less the same, and then, you know, so it kind of has to happen again. And what's shattering about it is because of the level of your investment in the thing that needs to be let go. Good. Like, that's what's shattering about it.
Right.
And I think once then you've begun to get the sense of yielding into this other dynamic or this other, and you have, in my case, with contemplative prayer, meditation, a practice that sort of at least seeks to keep bringing me back into that that relationship, that flow, then yes, subsequent ones, you know, they can still be painful, or they can still be a bit disorienting, but it's like you know the cycle now, and it's not like you're having to be unmade at that really like something has already shifted, that the grip of that egoic identity has shifted, and now the process can still be quite deep, but it's not like everything falls to pieces yet again and yet again.
Okay, that's very, it's a very helpful articulation of that idea. You write something, I think, really, to me, I find moving, especially during a time of pandemic. You know, you write about how when we are stripped of our stories, we share more fully in the vulnerability of all creation. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, how that is the case. You think that's so? Is it, and I guess a side question to that, can we fashion stories of unity with creation, or is it somehow crucial that vulnerability attend the disruption of our own narratives? Must, to be vulnerable, must we live without these strong egoic life stories?
I guess what I would say is that, so first, that kind of the touching into the shared vulnerability of all creation, I think, certainly again in my case, looking back, I would say a lot of my life project had been to protect myself from vulnerability and from, you know, from fear and from risk, and all of which actually are intrinsic to creaturehood. Like, <That's right. laughs> and so that was a lot of, you know, my, I didn't know I was doing this, obviously, but a kind of a part of the project. And for me, the form that took was intellectual. So it's about trying to understand the world, get a grip on things so that I'm less vulnerable and I'm kind of have mastery and those kinds of things. As that falls away and is taken away, and if you're going to kind of emerge from that actually having grown and deepened integrity as opposed to just remaining shattered, then part of what has to happen is the embrace of your vulnerability and your fear and your limit. And the way in which you aren't particularly special, you're just, you know, you're just a creature among creatures, no better, no worse than anyone else. And kind of living into that thing, that kind of way of being, then opens you up to our shared vulnerability. Here we all are, at risk and afraid and vulnerable. Here we all are, fellow creatures. And so what awakens in us is this shared sense of our vulnerability and our mortality, and that, so then that notion of the communion of all things again starts to not just be a nice idea, but actually we're on the inside of it. And so I guess then in relation to the last part of your question about the story we fashion about our, again, I think I'd see that the same way as the story we tell about God. We do want to put that then into words. We do want to give it articulation, but it's different if it comes out of that shared knowledge of our communion in vulnerability, as opposed to, okay, I understand intellectually that, you know, we're interdependent beings and this is the story I tell about the world. It might be the same words, but it opens access to it, to a reality, if you're actually speaking that out of the lived experience of it.
That really resonates with me, what you're saying, Sarah. It does. As I think about my own experience, for example, if I were kind of writing my own sort of life narrative with different moments in their transformation, shattering and adaptation, yeah, and all the rest of it, you know, there's the early story, kind of the coming of age, where, you know, do I or do I not wish to belong to this religious faith? Do I or do I not claim it? Which is kind of the big question, which can change how you live. It changed how I live. It sent me on a 2-year mission, for example. But then, you know, the questions that occur later are subtler but vaster. Like, so what are the implications then of this thing to which I belong? At first, it's like, okay, I'll say yes, you know, but there's kind of there can be kind of an immaturity about that still too. It later, the implications, you realize just how deeply that causes you to go to make the changes that you make, to make yourself vulnerable to others, what your responsibilities are to others, how that itself disrupts how you live or thought you might live, has implications for how you work, how you think, who you want to be. That's my experience.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think you're right, Matt, about that sense that there are obviously, and that's why it's about continuous conversion, there are layers to this. And I guess, you know, it is possible to be converted, as it were, to the faith or to Christ, and that be genuine and sincere, but also then to kind of say, okay, well, I'm here now, and now I'll live my life, in a sense, out of these values, connected to this community, deploying this faith, as it were. And that's where I say I think there can be contexts in which our faith or our religion, our religious belonging, can function as a bit of a block to growth or to the deepening of faith, because that's now become the egoic narrative.
Yes.
So that's now become the thing I am. I know, and it stays at a fairly immature or not in adult development terms a socialized self level, more than a transforming self level.
That's a very profound thought. I think that's exactly right. It's true to my experience. Let me ask you. You've mentioned contemplative living, writing. Your life experience obviously contributes to your writing. I mean, I think you write beautifully about these kinds of things. Do you also find that your contemplative writing has contributed to your life experience? Does it all flow from experience into writing, or have you found that your writing also contributes to your life experience?
I think I had never asked myself that question quite that way, so thank you for it. But yeah, I think it does, because as someone who is given life by being able to integrate my experience with what I can say about my experience or how I understand things, so that kind of dynamic between, you know, experience and articulation, that's something I just, you know, it's just gives me life to do that, and is part of the work of integration for me. Obviously, as I really, because I, like many, I guess, writers and thinkers, I write to think. It's as I'm writing, as I'm seeking to say, how would I say this in a way that somebody else might relate to, then of course you ask the question, well, what do I mean, or what do I think, or hang on a sec, I'd made this connection, but what actually is it? And, you know, so doing that work, as that happens, then that flows into how I respond to life, what I notice about my life, what then strikes me, or what I can, further connections I can make. So that comes out in my living and then comes back to the writing. And yeah, so there is definitely relationship. And I think that that's actually also what's going on in the relationship between what in the Christian tradition, the relationship between the cataphatic and the apophatic in mm-hmm. faith. So, you know, the apophatic is that notion of the silence, unknowability, the things we can't say about God and we just need to sort of be in the mystery. The cataphatic is worship, praise, words, songs, images, the kind of material expression of that ineffable experience. And again, there's that necessary relationship. It is, as we articulate, as we put it into words, it draws us back into the silence in a different way and vice versa.
It's beautifully said. Can I ask you one more question? Kind of, it takes up the same kinds of categories, and I wonder how you'd articulate the relationship between these. This comes from your book, Resurrection: A Moral Imagination, and there is a chapter in there where part of the chapter you talk about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and you say this. You say, if I have failed, it's one thing if someone is kind to me, refrains from judging me, invites me to try again. It is another thing entirely if someone shares with me her own story of failure and walks with me. This is the difference between charity and solidarity. It's a beautiful thought, Sarah. And I'm wondering if you find that contemplative practice has helped you bridge the divide between those two, charity and solidarity, or if that's only really bridgeable through hard life experience.
I think it does. I think the contemplative practice does. Though it is, in a way, inseparable from hard life experience, and I think, but that's, everyone has hard life experience, so yeah. I think what enables the bridging of the gap is what I call, I mean, not originally, but what I think of as humility in the sense of that poverty of spirit. So I think what stops us from that kind of solidarity is often that I still have something to defend about myself or my image, or so I actually don't want to let on to anyone else that I've been there too, or I'm as broken as they are, right, or whatever. It's being able to let go that attachment, you know, that defendedness, that need, that sense that I need to somehow defend that, that enables the true solidarity, and that is the movement of humility or poverty of spirit. And I guess when you think about that, and then you think about the humility of Christ, or the self-emptying, the poverty of Christ. Again, I think if we just stay at the level of the religious language, we think we know what that means, or we think, oh yes, you know, Jesus was God and then God came among us and gosh, that was a nice thing to do, and you know, but actually, if you think that, that's what that means. It's that level of being with us, that level of, and not just being with us to be nice, again, charity, but like that level of poverty. That's a different way of thinking about it, isn't it?
It is. It is. I must say, Sarah, I have loved reading your work. I think that you have a real gift for expressing things of a spiritual or morally transformative nature. It gives me delight to read your work and to talk with you here. Just as we close, what is your what currently occupies your mind? What are you writing about these days?
As you know, I lead this contemplative worshipping community called Benedictus, and so my weekly writing is the reflection for that community. And I guess in a way, that might be part of what's helped me, you know, find language and ways of speaking about some of these matters that people can get some access to, because I'm seeking always to do that with a community. What I'm thinking about at the moment actually is there's a lot of literature that's beginning to emerge in Australia. I don't know if it's happening yet in the US, about life post-pandemic and the possibilities of a new, you know, a better normal or a new normal or whatever. And a lot of that writing I agree with. There's a kind of, you know, quite progressive thinking about that. But what's striking me about it is that there's very little about the interiority, what I'm starting to call the interiority of recovery. And what is the spiritual maturity that is called for and to be called forth if we are to live into something different? And that's what I'm starting to try to grapple with.
Well, I would love to read Sarah Bachelard on that subject. on the new normal, the transformed normal, the transformed state, the whatever new novelty might come out of where we currently are. It is such a delight to talk to you here today, Sarah. Thank you for taking the time, and thank you for your beautiful work.
Thank you so much for having me, and it's been wonderful to explore the questions with you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Brooke Brown and Sam Jacob. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you're interested in other episodes of this podcast or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.